dedicated to the memory of Elaine Pomerantz's mother. This is to your insight, Chana Bas Shlomo V'Yester, and we hope that all of our learning should be L'Iloi Nishmatah. Of course, this is also the night after Rachel Imenu, so the special kind of building on it and connected to that Hashpa as well. Unfortunately, you know, we're continuing a topic that is somewhat distressing, somewhat painful. Some of the issues involving the Adonah. I need to recapitulate a little bit of what we talked about last week, just in very brief outline form, in order to build on it. Last week, the basic idea was that the gateway to an Adonah's protection is a Psak Basin that says the husband is obligated to divorce his wife. Now, when will the Basin issue that Psak? And again, this is by way of review. That was a fundamental machlokes between the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. According to the Rambam, whenever a woman simply says, Ma'is alai, I can't stand living with the guy, that's all she has to say. Basin will issue an order that the husband must give a get. And once Basin issues that order, even physical compulsion, beating him up, putting a gun to his head, is absolutely mutter. Halachically, I'm not referring to legally, because that is the principle of the Gemara, that we force a person till he says he wants. But she has to have a psak. According to the Rambam, such a psak is very easily obtainable. However, the halacha is not according to the Rambam, unfortunately, perhaps. The halacha is based on the shita of Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson. And Rabbeinu Tam rules that we do not allow a woman to obtain a get by a simple claim of Mois Alai, because Shema Einaha Nasna Biacher. That simply means perhaps she is using this as a pretense to have an affair with somebody. And therefore, according to Rabbeinu Tam, a woman can get a kafiyah order. Kafiyah, not to be confused with the Arab headdress. Kafiyah just means a compulsion order, an order that would justify compulsion only if she has, and I'm going to use some technical terms, an amakla or an amasla, which basically means substantiation of her claims, such as abuse, physical or emotional, non-support, failure to cohabit, or even male adultery, although male adultery is not as great a sin as female adultery, but a man that is having affairs, that is grounds for a woman to be able to get a kafiyah order. Now, as I indicated, in Eretz Yisrael proper, it is said that the percentage of tikkun, of a tik, where a woman gets a kafiyah order, is only around 5%, meaning 95% of the time, the Beit Din might advise. Again, language is very important here. If the Beit Din advises a get, if the Beit Din suggests a get, if the Beit Din says it's a good idea, if they say a mensch would give a get, however that is expressed in Hebrew, that does not allow kafiyah. They have to use magic words, of which they're very well aware, chayav. And as I say, that's a relatively small percentage. And the reason why it's a small percentage is, according to the Rambam, it would be 100% of the time. But the reason why, according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's a small percentage is, if indeed a woman is entitled to a get only if she has been abused and the like, sometimes a Beit Din is reluctant to make a finding on that, because often there are no witnesses. Some cases there are. Often it's he said, she said. There are some questions as to how bad must emotional abuse be to be bad, because everybody yells once in a while, so to speak. Well, shouldn't everybody, but a lot of people yell once in a while, etc. So as a result, the Bat Beit Din are really afraid of issuing these orders. Let me explain what's at stake. Because if a Beit Din says the man could be forced to give a get, when in fact he's not guilty of this behavior, the get is possible. It's possible. Because it is what is called a get ma'usa, a compelled get. So the Bat Beit Din are afraid, and we talked about the idea that there is a process now to educate dayanim in different cultures to understand what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, and the like. Okay. Now, The other point I want to remind you of, and again, I apologize for the chazara, but we will get to something new in a minute, is that once you get that based in order, which is really the pot of gold, it's very valuable, what is done with that order, there's a very big difference between Eretz Yisrael and every other country. In the United States, even if a woman is fortunate enough to get that order, that doesn't mean she's going to get the get. Because, so what? Based in issues in order. What if husband just refuses to obey? What's going to happen in the United States? There is separation of church and state. A secular court or the police are not going to force a man to give a get. So what's going to happen is maybe he'll be excommunicated. But that doesn't, you know, so you go to the other shul down the street. Maybe he won't be allowed to go to his child's bar mitzvah. You know, that might happen, etc. But there's not too much you can do. Run his picture in the Jewish press or whatever. Sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. You have ORA, organization for the resolution of Akunot, which has demonstrations. They claim that they've gotten 200 gitten that way, but I know other cases where it doesn't work. Again, psychologically it's very tricky because sometimes it's better to be nice than to be aggressive. It's a very strange dynamic. Sometimes the more a husband is shamed, the more he digs in his heels. So the rabbi has to be a bit of an expert psychologist in terms of how to motivate people. In Eretz Yisrael, once we have the magic kefiah order, which is hard to get, a lot of things can happen. A man can go to jail. A man can lose his driver's license. He can have his passport suspended. He can lose his job. His bank account can be frozen. And the reason that's so is because in Eretz Yisrael, there is no real, even though the government might be chiloni to some degree, but there is no legal separation of church and state. And as you know, the batei din of the rabbanut in matters of kiddushin v'gerushin are the legal courts of the state of Israel. And if that's so, once a beit din has issued such a kefiyah order, that is backed up by the laws of the Knesset in many, many ways. So one has to be aware that a beit din in Israel is also a legal court, which is not the case in the United States or any other country. Now, as I indicated, therefore, Agunot, once they get their order, now it's hard to get the order, once they get the order, are in a much, much better position than they would be in any other country in the world. But it's still not a panacea, because a lot of cases of Agunot, the guy is already in prison. Or sometimes the guy is so malicious that he's willing to languish in prison and not give his wife a get. So even in Israel, we do have agunah problems, both because many women do not get the psak basin, and even if they get the psak basin, there's still recalcitrance. In the United States, it's even worse, because number one, a woman might not get a psak basin, and number two, even if she does, there's not a lot that happens, particularly if the husband is going off the derech and he doesn't even care what a beis din says. It makes no difference. He doesn't care about being part of the Orthodox community. So, as a result, people are exploring what can be done to encourage or put pressure on someone to give a get when there is no psak beis din, which might be difficult. So I had mentioned last week the issue of Facebook rallies, these types of rallies, and the halachic question is shaming somebody considered coercion? Because remember, before a psak beis din, if a woman hires goons to beat the guy up, that is a puzzle get. It's only a psak beis din that allows kefiah. Because there is a principle called get mu'usah, a forced get. Okay? So the question becomes, well, what if we're not forcing him? We're not threatening him. We're not hitting him. We're not taking his property. We're just embarrassing him. Is that considered to be coercion? So most poskim say it is not, and as a result, it is a permissible way of putting pressure on somebody. Some people say it is coercion, but that seems to be a very big minority opinion. Now, whether these rallies work is another question. I'm not endorsing them necessarily, but halachically, the get that is obtained would not be possible. Okay. So this brings us to some things that are utilized both in America and in Israel, but in a somewhat different way. And that is, let's talk about, and this is where we ended last week, let's talk about prenuptial agreements. Prenuptial agreements are mechanisms that are being encouraged in order to possibly, at a time when people are in love and they're getting married and they're not even thinking about divorce, but there is a thought about creating a structure which, if God forbid there's going to be a divorce, would streamline and facilitate and expedite the obtaining of a debt, right? These are prenuptial agreements. Theoretically, by the way, they don't have to be prenuptial. Even if people are married 10 years, they can have such an agreement during the marriage, but again, the idea is to put it there right at the outset. So first of all, before I get into what these agreements say and whether they're halachically valid, let me just mention some objections that people have spiritually. There are some rabbis and some couples who say, particularly men often, I don't want to sign a prenuptial agreement because how can I possibly talk about what's going to happen if we get divorced? Doesn't that mean that I'm entering marriage with a hava amina, which I thought in my mind that we might get divorced? And it is improper to bring any thoughts of divorce to the happy occasion of marriage. This is what some people say. But suffice it to say, that is not, cannot be a logical argument, simply because the ksuba itself, which is halachically required in every marriage, is basically a document that specifies what is going to happen in the event of death or divorce. Now, people say, yeah, we don't know what the ksuba means, so we don't think about that. But you're supposed to know what the ksuba means. In point of fact, it is actually halachically improper to conduct the Jewish menah. You don't have to know the Aramaic translation of every word. No one's going to say you have to sit down and translate the ksuba. But you have to know what the ksuba says, right? Because you're assuming an obligation. So obviously, Chazal didn't have the problem in taking care of contingencies, worst case scenarios, even at the time of marriage. And again, it's the same question about, should you get life insurance? Oh, well, how can I think about, dying? Am I supposed to bring in the thoughts of death? Yeah, I mean, you do what you need to do to avoid problems. So I would think that that's not considered to be a problem. Other people bring up the argument that they don't like to add anything to a Jewish religious ceremony. It smacks of reform. We have a tekes, we have an official ceremony. What are you bringing in new stuff? Well, I mean, again, it's really an augmentation of the ksuba. And if you really don't want to change the ceremony, so sign it before the chuppah. So don't sign it. I mean, some rabbis bedavka say, do it at the ceremony. Okay, you don't want to do it at the ceremony, so do it a week before the ceremony. I mean, you don't have to link it to the religious part of the marriage itself, although a lot of rabbis specifically want to do it. Well, the most common prenuptial agreement that is used in the United States, and a somewhat different version is used in Eretz Israel, is an agreement that was prepared. The primary author of it was Rav Mordechai Willig, who's a very chashuv Talmud Chacham, a rabbi in Riverdale and a Rosh Yeshiva at NYU, and we would call him a Haredi type of person, American Haredi, not the same as Israel Haredi, but at least American Haredi, and the like. So he really knows his stuff, and he prepared a prenuptial agreement, and this is known as the RCA prenup, and you can get it for free. You used to have to pay for it, you can get it for free. At the websites and the like. Some rabbis are so gung-ho that they have urged the RCA to pass a resolution that no rabbi can be Masada Kedushin unless there is some type of prenuptial agreement. Baruch Hashem, that was defeated because ultimately each rav has to decide for himself. You shouldn't have an organization telling member rabbanim what they can and what they cannot do. But again, some rabbis are very gung-ho. And they insist on doing it, and they insist on doing it publicly, either under the chuppah or during the Kabbalah's panim. Other rabbis don't like it, and I'll discuss the issue, and they don't use it. Other rabbis are parev, they're not going to push it, but if the family wants, they'll do it, right? So you'll have all sorts of ranging from, kosher, treif, to parev, different ranges of views regarding the prenuptial agreement. Let me tell you what the prenuptial agreement says, and then I'll tell you what the halachic problem might be and why it actually is not a halachic problem. The ICA prenup is, unfortunately, it gets more and more complicated every year because they keep on adding different things. So the ICA prenup is actually three separate agreements in one. And they could be separated out. In theory, you could do one agreement without the other agreement. You don't need all three. But they try to put it all in a big package, so it's a little confusing. So I'm going to take it as agreement one, two, and three. And each one could function separately. Agreement one is simply legally described as an arbitration clause. And the arbitration clause simply says, we agree, husband and wife agree, that in the event we have machlokas between us regarding living together, keeping the marriage alive, we will submit our dispute to a beis din. And, of course, they should specify what the beis din is. Obviously, the RCA's recommendation is that it be the Beis Din of America, which is the RCA's beis din located in Manhattan. Rav Gedalia Schwartz of Chicago is the head of the beis din in Manhattan, so occasionally he has to commute and the like. Now, let's just stop there, because that is really a separate agreement. What is accomplished by that piece of paper? The answer is the following. What is accomplished by that piece of paper is you have created what is called a legal and binding arbitration agreement. Now, why is that important? Once, this is left out for again, once parties have signed an arbitration agreement to go to a beis din, that becomes a legally enforceable contract. So, that means two things. If husband, again, this can go husband and wife against wife as well, but let's assume it's the husband that's creating the problem. It's not always the case. I don't mean to suggest it's only husbands, but let's use that as our motto. If husband refuses to go to beis din, he refuses to go to beis din, the wife has the right to bring an action in a civil court to get a court order directing the husband to go to beis din. And if the husband refuses, the husband can be fined and possibly even imprisoned for civil contempt, which you couldn't do if you wouldn't have that arbitration agreement. And the courts of New York in particular long ago decided that even if the arbitration agreement is to go before a religious body, it is not a violation of church and state to order the arbitration, because this is just neutral. The state is not saying, follow halakha. The state is simply saying, go to the arbitrator that you chose. So the first thing that an arbitration agreement accomplishes is, it is a method that enables a woman to force a recalcitrant husband, or vice versa, to go to the beis din. Okay. Second thing it accomplishes, when parties enter an arbitration agreement, that also means the decision of the arbitrator may be compelled, may be forced. So, let's say husband goes to beis din, and beis din paskens, the husband is chayav to give a get. Well, had there not been an arbitration agreement in the United States, the woman could do nothing with that information except go to the Jewish press or get a cheirim or something. But if there's an arbitration agreement, she can go to civil court, and the civil court will order the husband to obey the arbitration agreement, and if not, the husband will go to jail and the like. Now, here's the thing. You may ask Akasha, wait a second. A civil court puts a guy in jail unless he gives a get. Isn't that a get ma'usa? The answer is no. Once there's a psak beis din, all legitimate compulsion is permitted. Right? So that's what the arbitration agreement does. Now, you understand that in the state of Israel, not Israel, such an agreement is totally superfluous. Because at the end of the day, all the arbitration agreement accomplishes is it forces the husband to go to beis din, and it forces him to obey the beis din if the beis din issues an order. In Eretz Yisrael, you already have that. In Eretz Yisrael, legally, the husband has to go to beis din, and if they issue an order, he has to comply. So in Eretz Yisrael, there would be no Tuolis whatsoever. In other words, this part of the RCA agreement does not exist in Eretz Yisrael simply because there is nothing the arbitration agreement...
You have to sign the Shtarbo Arut.
No, I understand you do, but legally you can be compelled to do it. In other words, you don't need an agreement. I mean, he can be ordered to do it. In other words, it's already there. Okay. Now, the arbitration agreement alone, however, ultimately is not sufficiently protective of a woman for the following reason. The arbitration agreement gives you a way to force the guy to go to Beis Din, and it gives her a way to force him to obey the Pesach Beis Din, but it doesn't guarantee she'll get a Pesach Beis Din. As I indicated, because of Rabbeinu Tam, it may be difficult for women to get a Pesach Beis Din. So the arbitration agreement is absolutely, halachically, 1,000% valid. There is no halachic problem with an arbitration agreement at all, but it only works if ultimately she gets a Pesach, which she might not be able to. Because of this, the RCA, and here's where the Rabbi Nick comes in as well, developed a supplementary additional agreement that doesn't require a Pesach Beis Din. And this is a support agreement. Now this is a little more complicated, needs a little more halakhic explanation. But essentially it says something like, and this is going to have many forms. And this says something like, in the event we are not living under the same roof and we are separated, I will pay my wife, let's say husband will pay wife, $300 or 1,500 shkolim for every day that we are separated until such time as I deliver a get in front of a Beis Din. It is a support agreement creating an incentive to give a get because you want to stop the clock from running. Now, why is that, and what the figure will be, okay, we'll discuss that as well. What is that involved in, what is the issue there? So let me explain something. We have a halacha, which we've already gone through a number of times, called get ma'usa. A get that is obtained by compulsion is invalid unless it's pursuant to a psak based in that the husband is chayav to give a get. Any type of compulsion makes the get pasul. It's pasul, unless there's a psak based in. But there's a famous tshuva from the Rivash. The Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Sheshet, was a great posek. It's not clear if he's a Rishon or an Achron. He literally straddled the era of the Rishonim and the Achronim. I believe he was in Mallorca or North Africa, or in both places at different times. But the Rivash is one of the greatest of the poskim. And the Rivash developed a principle that if the compulsion is unrelated to the get, but the get is a way of getting out of the compulsion, it's valid. Now, let me give you the example of the Rivash. A man was in prison for counterfeiting. He committed a crime. A man was in prison for counterfeiting. He was also being ma'ake his wife. His wife's brothers had powerful connections with the government. And through bribery and protexia, they would be able to get him out. But they said, why should we help you? So they basically told the person, if you will execute a get and give it to our sister, we will get you out of prison. Your choice is stay in prison or give a get. He agreed to give a get in order to get out of prison. But then he made the following argument. After he got out, he argued the get was no good. Because he said, if my only choice was stay in prison or give the get, I gave the get under compulsion or duress, the get is no good. This is a typical bad man attitude, where after you get what you want, you then make some halachic argument that it's no good. Because the man's argument is, I didn't give the get willingly, because my choice was rot in jail. And I'll tell you that, I assume that New York in prisons in the 15th century were probably a little worse. There was no cable TV or whatever it was. So the Rivash was mechadesh, very logical argument, that hey, if somebody would go over to a man and say, give a get or I'll put you in prison, That would be coercion. Because he's being put in prison because he didn't give the get. But here, he's not in prison because he didn't give a get. He's in prison because he's a counterfeiter. So you're not using the get to create the pressure. You're using the get to take him out of the pressure that came for an unrelated reason. The Rebush says that's not a get move. Now, I'll give you an actual case I know of in Baltimore that was based on this same Rebush, although it had a bizarre ending. There was a man in Baltimore who was ma'agein his wife for 19 years. He didn't give her a get. He moved out, he claimed, whatever he was saying, he was an idiot, I mean, he was either a Russian or an idiot. He claimed that he was still working on Shalom Bayis, even though he was not even living, he was living 500 miles away. Their oldest daughter was getting married. He had owed child support on a lot of his minor children, but she did not pay. So the Rabbanim advised the woman, when your husband shows up at the wedding, you should have the police arrest him for non-payment of child support. When he's arrested, Suri Bush, we will go to him and we will say that wife will drop charges if a get will be delivered. Of course, that does mean she's forfeiting money to which she's entitled. In a sense, that's putting her on a certain degree of extortion. But the idea was we're using the imprisonment. Now, you see the halacha, you see how this fits the Rebush? He's not being thrown in prison because he didn't give a get. He's being thrown in prison for an unrelated charge, which will be dropped if he gives a get. So that would be a way of encouraging. So the story was he was actually arrested at his daughter's wedding. It worked perfectly. He was taken into custody. But she could not stand to have him in prison. She said, "That's not. How can I have him spend even one night in jail?" So she dropped the charges before she got the jail. Now you would think, if there was any element of human decency, some hakaras hatov. No. And she went back to being an aguma. So Nashim Sitkanias sometimes create a problem here. They're too good to people who are not deserving of their chesed. Okay. But you see, halakhically, that you see exactly how this fits the Rebush's paradigm. Because this is called kafia mimakam acher. Compulsion that is coming from an unrelated matter. Now, let's take support. Halakhically, a husband is obligated to support his wife. That is a halakhic obligation. If you're immediately thinking about kolel and other situations, let me just point out, a woman can waive that right, but it's not an obligation. A woman has the right to insist that her husband work and support her, but if out of the goodness of her heart and out of her beshap of education and out of her values to create a home of Torah, she is willing to set aside her rights temporarily or even longer, Baruch Hashem, that's a great zechus, but every kohen man has to know that this is a gift that his wife is giving him. This is not an entitlement that he has. Al pi din, a husband is obligated in the support of his wife. Now, let's say a man gives a get because it's too expensive to support his wife. Now, you could say, that's compulsion. He's giving a get because otherwise he's going to have to pay a lot of money. But obviously not, because the compulsion, the monetary money, the money that is putting pressure on him, is not punishment for not giving a get. It's a chiyuv of support. So consequently, a man who gives a get to cut down on a support obligation is not a mavusa, because that's exactly the Rebush's case. After all, every get you're cutting down on a support obligation because you're replacing the support obligation with the ksum, which is only a single payment, which is likely to be less. Now, according to halacha, a support obligation can be quantified in an agreement. Meaning, in a normal case, you know, you get married to your spouse, you know, you don't say how much money I'm going to give for food, clothing, shelter. Right? Normally it's whatever is proper, and theoretically if it went to a basin, the basin would determine what it is. But theoretically, there is nothing wrong with a contract that says this is the amount of money I will give her support. So, agreement number two of the RCA is simply a quantification of support agreements when we're not living under the same roof. So it's not a get Melissa. It's not, this is why wording is so important. If the agreement would say, for every day you are not giving a get, you will pay a fine of $100. That would be absolutely invalid, because that is punishing a man for not giving a get. And unless there's a psak based it, that's compulsion. I'm giving a get to avoid a fine. But that's not what this says. This does not say we are punishing you for not giving a get. We are simply saying you are chayav in mizonos, and this is the amount of mizonos that you're chayav. You're giving a get to get out of your chayav mizonos. Well, every get gets me out of my chayav mizonos. That's not a get melissa. So, this is the idea of the... Now, here is the trick, though. The amount has to be high enough that it puts pressure on the man, but it has to be low enough that we realistically look at it as support and not kenas. Because if it's kenas, it's get melissa. If it's mizonos, it's not get melissa. So, for example, an agreement that would say husband is going to pay $5,000 a day, even if he's very wealthy, if that's not, unless that's what you normally get. So there are women that live with that standard or more. But if that's not her standard of living. So you have to be mishayer, a basin would have to, not the basin, but the parties themselves under the guidance of a rav. You don't need a basin. Again, you don't need a basin for this. Under the guidance of a rav, they would try to determine a figure. That's what you might call the high end of mizonos. That would include, of course, food, clothing, shelter, whether it's mortgage payments or rent, utilities, transportation. It would also include a child support component and the like. Of course, child support may be payable after the divorce as well. But the concept would be that every day that you're still halachically married, you got to pay this amount, and you can only terminate it by giving a get. Because you're not allowed to be married once you give a get, right? So that's the mizonos document. Now the mizonos document is stronger than the arbitration document, because unlike the arbitration document that would require a psak based in that he's chayav to give a get, the mizonos document creates built-in incentives to give a get that do not depend on the decision of a based in. That may be hard to get, right? That's called a mizonos document. It's a prenuptial quantification of mizonos, and the yesod of that is based on the tshuva of the rivash. Everyone understands the underlying concept. That is, again, I'm not gonna go over the particular language, that is the common prenuptial that is used in Eretz Yisrael, if it's used. In the Haredi world, they don't use it, but by and large. But which basically provides a quantification of the zonos, and that avoids get mousa problems, because that is kefiya al yidei davar acher. That, of course, does not stop a woman from having a tikkun based in and getting a kefiya order as well, but this can work even without a kefiya order, because this is a mizonos obligation. By the way, even without a prenuptial mizonos, this is one of the strategies what they did themselves use. Meaning, sometimes if a based in feels, husband ought to give a get. But they're reluctant to say he's chayav because they can't figure out the whole story. They will issue a mizonos order. In other words, it's not only an agreement. Sometimes a mizonos is a based in order as a way of getting the guy to give a get. So what they did, use it as a backup when they're unwilling to make a finding of kfiya because of difficulties in Rabbeinu time. So mizonos is fine. Again, some people complain it's get melissa, but absolutely not. Unless it's very high, so it's an obvious punishment. It, generally speaking, is considered to be mizonos, and according to the Rivash, that would be fine. Some people have a philosophical problem. They basically say, well, if the basin hasn't said he has to give a get, why should we create incentives at all? But the answer is that even when a basin doesn't say he must give a get, it often is very apparent that he should give a debt, and I think a Mazonas agreement would be a good way. Well, are Mazonas agreements panaceas? Are the ICA's agreements panaceas? Absolutely not. Number one, if you're rich enough, you're willing to pay the rich and sadistic enough, you'll pay the price. Okay? One thing. Number two, if you're poor, you don't have the money. So what's going to happen? Yeah, okay, sue me for $1 million. You know, whatever it is. I don't have the money, right? What are you going to do about it? Number three, there are plenty of ways in Israel and in America to conceal assets or move property around, etc. So what's going to happen, right? So the truth of the matter is that I think the RCA sometimes has too much faith. You know, I'm an attorney myself, and attorneys understand that agreements, you know, people think, oh, you're signing agreements? Of course, agreements, that's it, contract. That's the end of it. Well, there's a tremendous merchak between signing an agreement and having money in your pocket, and or more importantly, having a debt, you know, in your pocket and the like. So sometimes non-lawyers have such faith in the written contract that they think that written contracts solve all problems. Unfortunately, they do not. But nevertheless, it's better than nothing. So if somebody were to ask me, is there anything wrong with the RCA agreement? I would say there's nothing wrong with it. Is it potentially beneficial? It is potentially beneficial, there's no question. If it doesn't help, what is the phrase? Lo yazor, lo mazik, whatever it is. So, you know, it's not going to hurt. And I can tell you that there is no halachic problem with the RCA agreement, although it's not as wonderful as people said. Now, there is a third component of the agreement, which has nothing to do with Adonai at all. But it happens to be very, very important, but it's a totally different matter. And that is, how will the parties resolve their property disputes? And this is a very, very major issue. Because, as you know, under halacha, the property rights of a woman in property are very, very different than under a secular law in the United States. And basically, the RCA agreement gives the parties options whether they want the property division to be decided on halacha or they want it to be decided based on dina de malchus adina. And halacha will permit them to make that choice, and that's very important. Now again, that has nothing to do with aguna, but it's important that there be a notion. Let me point out that suffice it to say, it is halachically forbidden for anyone to take another Jew to secular court. So there's an issue for women, and this maybe deserves a share of its own. Even if a woman will do better in secular court than she will do in a beis din, it is forbidden to go to a secular court, and a woman has to go to a beis din. But the RCA mechanism creates a structure where even in her agreement to go to beis din, she can stipulate that the beis din will apply the civil law. So in a sense, that is a valuable service because that will encourage people to go to Bat Din without feeling they're going to lose their property rights. And that is permitted because in Dine Mamonos, parties are allowed to agree to whatever they want to agree to. They can't agree to go to secular court, but they could agree that we want the Beis Din to apply the Din of the Malchus. So that I actually commend the RCA for doing, but as I say, that has nothing per se to do with the Aguna issue. And of course in Eretz Yisrael that would be largely irrelevant because the Bat Din initially decide property as well, but on the other hand there's also a provision where a woman could opt out. So that's in the law already, so that's not going to be, there's not going to be any agreement to that effect. So of the three parts of the RCA agreement, the only part you're going to have in Eretz Yisrael primarily is the middle one, which is the Mazonot provision. And the one. Now this is only one variation, there are different variations, but again, the most common prenup in Eretz Yisrael is the RCA one, or at least that part of the RCA one as modified. You can get copies, the National Conference of Young Israel Rabbis has English versions of it, you can get Hebrew versions of it, and the like. There are some more complicated versions. There's a person who wrote a version, very complicated, it's very ingenious, but very complicated, in which he says that the husband's mezonos obligation gets suspended if he proposes mediation. to the 30 minutes. There are all sorts of ways that stop the clock, that even if he doesn't even get, if he's willing to go to a mediator, then for 30 days the money doesn't accumulate, but if he doesn't listen to the mediator after 10 days, it starts up again. And it was complicated, like stop clock, you know, turning it on, turning it off, etc. The ICA is a bit simpler. It simply says, until you give a get, you've got to pay your mazonos, and there's nothing that stops it until you give a get. It's easier. It's easier to work than the other one. Okay.
There's another component in Israel. That's the Yerusha. They talk a lot about the that's Yerusha in English.
Inheritance.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, where they specify the problems of Yerusha so that the wife doesn't lose out.
In other words, in the case of divorce? Is it?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm going to have to check that. But okay, but those are property issues. Those are not the get percent. Yeah.
In the States, some people are signing reciprocal prenuptials so that to avoid the man coming on good.
Yes, yes. It is important. You know, we didn't talk about this a lot, but it is important to mention that men can 100% be agunim, if that's the correct word. And the reason is that because of the cheirim of Rabbeinu Gershom, a man cannot marry another wife until he divorces his first wife. And the other part of the cheirim is a man cannot divorce a woman against her will. So if a woman refuses to give a get, refuses to accept a get. Yeah, correct. If a woman refuses to accept a get, a man will initially be unable to marry, and she can make her demands and the like. So there are men that are agunim. Men do have certain, at least possible options, because the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom can be lifted by 100 rabbanim. It's not so easy to get. Sometimes you have connections, you can get it, but it's not that easy. And he deposits to get an escrow. But very, very definitely, a man can be an agun, and there are therefore reciprocal versions where the woman agrees to compensate him until she gets until she receives again.
There's no question of the same notes.
Yes, so the way it works is this. The way it works is, even in the RCA agreement, it is built in that, because otherwise, because here's the issue. If he has to pay until she gets a get, then she can refuse to accept the get and keep the clock running. So the RCA agreement provides that if the man deposits a get in Beis Din, his mazonos, at least his mazonos obligation, terminates. So she's not going to get more money with that. So even if it doesn't make her pay anything, she gets no benefit by keeping this going.
My impression from what you said was one of the differences between, at least before the prenuptials, was that in Israel you had fewer edicts to give a get, partially because there was so much power to enforce it once it was given. Whereas in America, because there was less power to enforce it, therefore it was perhaps easier to get the edict. Now that there's more power based on the prenuptials, do you think, or has there been any support to the fact that maybe the rabbis will then pull back on their willingness to give the tzav because of the fact that once they do, it may run into almost guaranteeing the get and then causing the problems that we're here?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, you're right. Issuing a kafiyah order is an enormous responsibility, because if it's wrong, the get is puzzled and the woman is an adulteress and the children are mamzerim. So if there are ways to get the get in ways other than that, a Beis Din would prefer not to go that way. And the mazonos order is an alternative mechanism. On the other hand, I would say that I believe that the primary difference between an Israeli Beis Din and an American Beis Din is more cultural than even halachic. That is, in America, there's more of a cultural sensitivity that when is a woman being abused or whatever it is. Meaning, they're more willing to say, hey, this is abuse, than they are in Eretz Yisrael, which is a tougher society, generally, as all of us know. I mean, after all, on some level, we all get abused many times every day. You know, so, hey, you know, live with it. I don't mean to say that. Things are very serious. So I think that cultural difference will continue to exist, even with that change. That's why the percentage in America is higher than in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
Yes, Rav Rose. So could you review the principles of preventing the Beit Din normally from and making the decision and giving a get without either party, when one party wants the get. Why can't the Beit Din, like say in the secular court, a man or a woman goes, or husband or wife goes to get a get, and normally it's not that difficult because one is not happy. And
right, but here's the thing. Let me just explain the basic difference. In secular divorce law, it is not the husband that divorces the wife. It is the court that declares the marriage terminated. In Jewish law, the Beis Din does not declare the marriage terminated. The Beis Din can simply order the man to do something. Menela, unless there's grounds for it, they cannot force him. You know, that's really the difference. Now, there are situations, I mentioned last week, there are situations of annulment. There are times when a Beit Din can declare that a marriage is not valid, such as fraud, mekach tod, right? Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva. If a woman discovered her husband to be gay after the marriage, she was not aware of it. She did not need a get. Some people, the famous, many of you know, Rabbi Emanuel Rapman, who was a very prominent rabbi in America, and he became the chancellor of Bar Ilan here, and he died a short while ago, maybe 2 years ago. And he was an esteemed person, and his motivations were totally l'shem shamayim, no question. But he advocated a very, very controversial response to these annulments. And he has some followers that are doing it, but they're not accepted. And that is, his basic argument is that people who tend to be bad had something wrong with them when the woman married them. Right? So people who abuse during a marriage must have had that propensity beforehand. People who torture their wives emotionally. So had she known she would be marrying such a bum, she never would have married him. So there's basically, he was using annulments in all sorts of scenarios, that whenever there's a problem down the road, that's a raya that he had something bad about. In other words, everything is a mekachtos. Now, the poskim do not accept that, because they say, if, for example, there was premarital abuse with another wife or another woman that she didn't know about, that's mekachtos. But if his record was clean, he just started doing bad things later, you can't go back and say, that's like saying, if I would have known I'd have to get a divorce, I never would have married her. You can't. If you take that logic, you never need again. And it's impossible to have a din of mekachtos that's so broad that it covers every case. So this is called the Rachman annulment. This is what they call it in the field. And the Rachman annulments, I think around 300 have been granted to women. 300 through the Rachman Basin. And there are people in the United States and even in Israel that are doing these things. But I have to say that these are not annulments that are accepted by virtually the Orthodox world as a whole. And if Chas V'Shalom, they're going to be children. Chas V'Shalom, some of the women are older, so Baruch Hashem, at least that's not a problem. But if there are going to be children, those
second
children
marriage.
Are going to, those from another marriage, the second marriage, those children are going to have real, real mamzerus problems. So you have to be very careful. You think you're doing the woman a favor, but in the long run, there may be some big problems. Now, you may know Rav Simcha Krauss, who again was he's a retired, very prominent rabbi from America, has a base now in Eretz Yisrael. He's trying to figure out what to do. I'm not sure exactly, I don't think anybody knows, I'm not sure if he knows exactly what is going to be done. I think he's working in the area of annulment and the like, but you have to be very, very careful. The Rachman annulment goes much, much too far. And as I say, I'm not criticizing Rabbi Rachman personally. There's no question his motivation was Avas Yisrael. But as I say, there's a certain danger in being lenient here, because you are affecting the status of children who might be stigmatized and excluded from being able to marry into Klal Yisrael.
Rabbi, even if there are no children, you're having adultery in the land if the first get is not valid.
That's very true. That's very true. But at least you could say, all right, adultery, she has a psak, so when she goes to Shemayah, you're right. I mean, other person would say it's adultery, but she could say, I have a basin.
Just point of clarification on the nullification, like Rav Moshe's case or another case where the woman discovered something and wanted to. If she discovered that he was gay, let's say I'll give you the not the case. Let's say she was 5'8" and she wanted to marry a man at least as tall as herself, and he had elevator shoes. And they got married, and they were together. And she recognized that, well, he's only 5'5", and I feel very uncomfortable. It's a mecca of toes.
Yep.
But once she discovered that, if she lifted with him even once, mecca of toes does not.
This is a minefield. This is a absolutely very excellent point. This is a minefield for annulment situations. Because the halacha is, if once she becomes aware of the problem, there is cohabitation, that is considered to be a mechila, a waiver of the problem. And this creates a real bind for dayanim as well. Because dayanim always kind of, unless it's severe abuse, dayanim always recommend shalom bayis. So a woman comes to a basin, and she says, mekach tais, I was deceived, I was cheated, I want out. And the dayanim say, well, let's just see if we can work it out. She works it out even one night. She's lost that night. Now she needs to get, now potentially she might be not good. Right, so
she nullified her mitzvah.
That's right. Recommending shalom bayis, which in the abstract is often a good thing to do, except, you know, in cases of real bad abuse, can turn out to destroy her ability to have an annulment claim, a mekach tos claim. That's 100% correct.
The interesting article McCarty showed this past week about this whole issue. That there's a huge difference here in Israel between what they did. Say, Chaim did 10 times as likely to offer
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's great. She actually saw the numbers. I knew that generally.
They confirmed the 5 or 7.
You saw specific numbers.
Nationally.
Yeah, Yerushalayim is very low. Yerushalayim is very low. We know this. But other places, looking at the more liberal parts of Israel. More liberally.
They also said
in this area,
that some quotes we need to use that.
Is that true? They're using that would be a big change. That would be a revolutionary change. Because as I say, both the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam reject the Rambam, which is very unusual. So it's hard to turn the clock back. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin in Efrat, he wrote a book about 25 years ago.
His PhD.
The basis of his book was essentially let's go back to the Rambam. That really was. His argument. He felt halacha took a wrong turn 600 years ago. Now let me mention just very, very quickly that the state of New York has two very, very interesting laws, only in New York. There one was passed in 1983 and one was passed in 1993, and other states have tried to do it, but only New York had the critical mass of religious Jews that were able, plus Sheldon Silver, they're very powerful. A Lower East Side
Speaker of the House
was able to get it through. Other states tried to do it. Maryland tried to do it, but it didn't make it in Maryland. But on the other hand, the New York Gag Law, a law that has been passed in South Africa, in Ontario province in Canada, which includes Toronto, and I think maybe even in Australia, and there's a version in England. So the New York Gag Law has had some influence internationally, even though it hasn't been so popular in the rest of the United States itself. Let me first tell you New York Gag Law number one, which was passed when Rav Moshe Feinstein was still alive. And therefore there was a psak from Rav Moshe that it is halachically proper. New York Gag Law number two was passed after Rav Moshe died, and there's a big halachic controversy, whether it's helping women or it's hurting women, because it might create pasukim. Let me explain the two laws very quickly. New York Gag Law number one basically says, I'm gonna cut out the legalese, so because it's written in a religiously neutral way, so it shouldn't be directly about religion. But the bottom line is, if a man wants to get a get in the state of New York, if a man wants to get a civil divorce, a man who wants to get a civil divorce in the state of New York will not be able to get a civil divorce unless he files an affidavit under oath that he has removed any impediments to the remarriage of the other spouse. Putting that in normal English, and this was written by my very good friend, Mr. Nathan Lewin, one of the great Jewish religious lawyers really in the world, one of the great lawyers in the world, who spends half of his year here, but he's in the Potomac, Maryland, but he is the author of this. And he said, what that means realistically is a man cannot get a civil divorce unless he swears, under threat of perjury, that he has given a get. to his wife. And even if he swears, he can be contradicted by the Masonic tradition. This is called the clergyman veto. The clergyman veto means the clergyman who married them files an affidavit. He didn't comply. He will be denied a civil divorce. So essentially, and this doesn't require a psak basin, essentially this means a man cannot get a civil divorce unless he gives his wife a get. And that's what it fundamentally means. Now, question is that a get Moshe? Is that telling a man, if you don't give a get, you don't get a civil divorce? So Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled that is not compulsion, because that is just denial of a benefit. He's already married. His status quo is married. All the state is telling him is, we're going to keep you as you are unless you get a get. You want something new? You want a matana? You want a gift from the state? Well, we're not going to give you that gift unless you stop victimizing your wife. So halakhically, that is absolutely good. Now, constitutionally, there's a bit of a problem, because the state is essentially saying, we're not going to give you a civil divorce unless you comply with Jewish law. But this has been on the books since 1983, so apparently, as they say, if the courts don't have a constitutional problem, I'm certainly not going to raise it. I think constitutionally there is an argument, but Rosh Hashem, they haven't noticed it yet. Well, they noticed it, but no, they don't have a problem. Now, New York has law number one, however. New York has law number one is, again, not a panacea, because there are some men who don't care if they get a civil divorce. Okay, whatever, they don't have a civil divorce, just save it. So in 1992, a second law was passed. Now, this is already after Rav Moshe's Petira. And this says the following. When a judge, when a family court judge or Supreme Court judge in New York, that's the trial court, divides up property and determines alimony and child support. So there's a whole potpourri of factors, you know, how much each party earns, education. The court may consider as a negative factor whether the husband is maintaining a barrier to remarriage. Again, putting it in normal English, in the state of New York, a judge can say the following. If you give your wife a get, your alimony will be $200 a week. If you don't give your wife a get, your alimony will be $500 a week. If you give your wife a get, you will get 50% of the proceeds of the residence that's sold. If you don't give your wife a get, she will get 100%. In other words, the court has the right to consider the maintenance of a barrier to remarriage as a negative factor in the awarding of alimony and child support. Now, that's a much more powerful pressure than simply telling the man, you don't get a civil divorce. But this is the rub. Many poskim have said that for a secular court to tell a husband, you will have to pay double the alimony until you give a get to your wife, is directly sanctioning him for not giving the get. And if the Beis Din didn't poskim that there's such a need, poskim have said that is a get me'usa, and any get given pursuant to that order, there are poskim that say the get is pasul. Now, the RCA as a body, there are individual members who agree with this, but the RCA as a body has strongly supported New York Get Law number 2, and they have said, no problem. The RCA is, you know, 900 members, but how many members vote on this? It's very small.
4,000.
4,000 members?
Over 1,000 members.
1,000, okay. How many members vote on these? It's actually a very small membership. But, what can I tell you? Rabbi Yashiv said, Gittin that are given under the New York Get Law number 2 are puzzled. And all I can tell you is, although I'm a member of the RCA, I respect the RCA, but RCA versus Rebel Yashiv, you know, it's not an even match. I'm referring to the Rebel Yashiv side, kind of outweighs it a little bit. And also, Rebel Yashiv's argument is very sporadic. It is very logical that, in fact, it isn't getting worse. Now, Rabbi J. David Bleich of YU took an extreme view, much more than Rebel Yashiv. He said, even if a man gives a get willingly in the state of New York, since he knows that if he doesn't, she could go to court and cause him to forfeit property, Rabbi Bleich said, this is very extreme, very extreme. He said, any get given in the state of New York since August 1992 is a suffek get me'usa, and he will not be Masadir Kedushin for any second marriage based on a get given after the date of New York Get Blown. That is very extreme. Rebel Yashiv absolutely did not say that. Rebel Yashiv only said if the husband is ordered to give a get by a court, because otherwise he'll lose property. That's Get Musa. He didn't say if the husband gives it willingly, but he's afraid there might be such an order. So, but again, it's interesting that Sheldon Silver was very, very perplexed. I mean, he pushed through this law to help women. He thought he would be a hero in the Frum community. He came through for the Frum people again. And all of a sudden, he gets all of these children. Again, it's puzzle, You made things much worse. So whatever. So this is still a very live machlokas. If gittin that are given under get law number two are puzzle. But get law number one, as they say, had not come over with Moshe, and it's 100% valid. Okay, I will stop here now. Good evening,
How could, in the United States, constitutionally, how could this be, any of this be judged?
That's an excellent question.
The state supporting
this. Yes, you're right. This needs a whole constitutional lawsuit. But the argument goes, the defense of the argument goes, that the state has a neutral interest in preventing the victimization of women, and this can be the victimization of women. But I know in Maryland, reading this law is not passed. The state attorney general, who is Jewish, said he thought it was unconstitutional entanglement within religion. It's a good argument.